This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and we thank you for your support for public radio in South Louisiana. And if you're so inclined, please give us a call to show that support at 855-893-9753. And if you contribute $15 a month, you can choose to receive a one-year digital subscription to the New York Times as your thank you gift. That's $180 a year, and the New York Times remains the newspaper of record in our country. 855-893-9753. We're joined by fine gentleman Clive Thompson, longtime contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and a monthly columnist for Wired. His latest book is Coders and Facebook's Algorithms Shape the News, Self-Driving Cars May Be Roaming the Streets, and Revolution on Twitter and Romance on Tinder. We live in a world constructed of code, and coders are the ones who built it for us. And from acclaimed tech writer Clive Thompson, this is an anthropological reckoning with the most powerful tribe in the world today, computer programmers, in a book that interrogates who they are, how they think, and what qualifies as greatness in their world, and what should give us pause. And Clive Thompson, we are in a brave new world. I don't think there's anyone in our listening audience who would deny that.
Well, you know, I definitely think that is what I've been hearing from people. One of the reasons why I wrote this book in the first place was that I sort of, you know, I think it's 15 or 20 years ago, if you told people, wow, you know, software is going to be central to your life, I don't think they would have understood it. But fast forward to now, everyone's, you know, using a smartphone all the time. Everyone's, you know, on Facebook and, you know, ordering cars on Uber. They get it. You know, they get that software is important. But what I discovered talking to them, you know, as a tech journalist, is that they don't really know anything about how it's made, right? It's just sort of this mysterious thing that shows up. So I wanted to say, okay, no, this is made by people who make decisions and about how you're going to live your life. And I think it would be interesting for us all to know more about who those people are and what makes them tick.
Well, you go into the types of people who go into coding, and this is an interesting group of people, isn't it?
You know, it really is. I mean, like, in many cases, I think it's the stuff that you might expect, right? So, you know, if you were to say to someone, computer programmer, what type of person is that going to be? They'd say, well, I guess they're probably pretty logical, right? And that's absolutely true. They're all really good at thinking systematically, at taking a complicated problem, breaking it down. But they have some other kind of funny things that you wouldn't expect. One is that they tend to be very obsessed with efficiency and optimization, you know? Because when you can program a computer, you can get a machine to do something for the same task over and over and over again. You can take boring tasks, and you can give it to the computer and say, do this for me. And that becomes almost like kind of like a, you know, like an emotional joy for a coder. So they wind up looking at the world and they just sort of look at it with x-ray vision. They're trying to find places where things are happening inefficiently or slowly, and they love the idea of getting in there with some software and speeding it up and optimizing it and taking away those repetitive tasks and giving them to the machines. So they are mm-hmm. optimizers to the core.
And you note, Clive, that coding is still dominated by white guys in the United States.
Very much so. Yeah, it's a very interesting and I think kind of tragic story, because when you go back to the origins of coding back in the 50s and the 60s, there was really a lot more women involved. Actually, more women than today, which is kind of nuts when you think about how sexist the 60s were. But it was very much an open door because no one knew how to code, and there was no sort of sense of what a coder looked like or who they were. They were just kind of like, well, if you can solve puzzles and do this logic puzzle, then, you know, we'll hire you and we'll train you. And so all these young women wandered into MIT and General Electric and whatnot, and they got hired as coders, and they had these amazing careers. But they started getting squeezed out in the 70s and the 80s because companies started realizing, oh, this software is now a really big deal. It's worth millions to our industry, and we need to hire coders that can maybe go and become management. Back in the 70s, they weren't going to put any women in management, so they mostly just started hiring guys to be the coders and started showing the women the door. So it's a cautionary tale. I would say it is getting a little better in recent years. You're seeing a significant uptick of women going into computer science. So we may find a decade from now that things look a little different.
The book is Coders, from Clive Thompson, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. And it goes into depth into some interesting areas. For example, a study by Carnegie Mellon finds that on-job listing sites, men are being shown six times as many ads as women are for high-paying jobs of $200,000 or more. That's something that is fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. The this is where you start to see machine learning becoming an interesting problem. Because, like, so that's AI, right? And what does AI do? Well, AI goes into the world and says, okay, what patterns can I find? And how can I help people out by sort of, you know, using those patterns? Now, that works pretty well if you want to, say, recognize a cat, right? You could say, okay, show me a million pictures of a cat. Great, now I've got AI that can recognize a cat. But what they started doing, a lot of these hiring firms would say, all right, let's use AI to match people to job offers. And so they would go and they would look at all the history of who got what jobs, and they would use that to train the AI to say, okay, now go, take your jobs, recommend them to someone who's going to get them. The problem is, of course, all the jobs in the past, you know, were, you know, often these more sexist industries that would pay men more than women. You've trained an AI to be sexist. And so this AI would go out and say, okay, the high-paying jobs, I guess those are the ones that we should push towards the men. The lower-paying jobs towards the women. So, you know, what we're learning, it's interesting, in creating AI, you got to be careful how you train these things, how you train these intelligences, because it's garbage in, garbage out. If you feed them anything that is biased or sexist or racist even, they will go off and they will be sexist and racist.
And you found that just 3 years ago, a reporter for The Guardian found that if you typed "are Jews" into Google search bar, the top recommendation in the autocomplete feature was "are Jews evil?" What did Google do about this?
Well, when Google was alerted to these, generally what happens whenever Google is alerted to one of these egregious examples, and there's been a couple of them, they go in and they sort of quickly, you know, hand code something to tell the computer, don't do that, right? But they're still confronted with this problem that, you know, they have these complex AI systems that are learning from observing the patterns of behavior of humans. And we humans, you know, are known for behaving in terrible ways, for saying, you know, racist things and anti-Semitic things and whatnot. So the challenge they've got is any system that is, you know, told, go learn from human behavior, you got to be very careful and watch what it does very closely. In this case, I don't think they were watching the output very closely. Otherwise, they would have noticed it earlier.
Lastly, Clive, how vulnerable are we to cybersecurity?
Cybersecurity is still, I think, a very dangerous thing, largely because we are now reliant on software for so many more things, you know, than just it used to be, like you had to worry maybe about banking or whatnot. But think about it now. There's software in, you know, one of these automatic doorbells, you know, that you can open and close. So now you've got software governing, you know, who gets inside your house, you know. And cybersecurity is growing as a concern. I found a lot of people that were very worried about this Internet of Things, where, you know, you've got software in your toaster, you've got software in your car. I think we're going to, as a society, have to be very careful in where we put software, because even when people are working really hard to make it as reliable as possible, it's still filled, you know, necessarily so, with a bunch of bugs, some of which people can use to get in through the back door. So I would say, you know, maybe take a bit of a breather on ordering these Internet of Things devices for a few years. You know, don't be the first adopter, because the first adopter is going to get bit with a lot of security problems.
The book is Coders, from Clive Thompson, and a man who knows the terrain well. And we thank you for joining us, and congratulations on your fine work, Clive.
Thank you. I had a good time being here.
Appreciate it. See you soon. And a reminder that as we round the turn and head to the home stretch for the Spring Member Fest, Wednesday being the final day if things go according to plan, we'd like to hear from you. And certainly if you're receptive to this hour of programming, please contribute now if you are so inclined, 855-893-9753. I heard right before the show, Ron and Mary Sue Gary contributed, and they are longtime listeners to WRKF. And Ron Gary was one of my professors at LSU, where he worked for almost four decades with great distinction. And we have a choice audience, people who are those who know and care about what's happening in our community and beyond, are the listeners of WRKF, and we're glad you're part of that family, and we would like for you to be an official member by becoming a member by calling us at 855-893-9753. $15 a month will get you a digital one-year subscription to the New York Times as your thank you gift, just $15 a month. That's less than 50 cents a day. 855-893-9753. And it was 35 years ago today that America and the world lost one of the great performers of all time, Marvin Gaye. He was killed by his father in Los Angeles, a murder, April 1, 1984, 35 years ago, and one day before Marvin Gaye's 45th birthday. He died much too young. He was cremated with his ashes scattered in the Pacific Ocean, and for those who remember him in his prime, he sounded pretty good no matter when he sang or where he played.